From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's nice to have the quiet Guy Ritchie come back. It's been a while since he's bored me to tears with his thoughtful conversation. His newest film as director is King Arthur. So, guys, so good to have you back here. So good to see you again.
It's lovely to be back.
And you know what's so much fun about this is that you do what you so often do is you make these guys talkers, you know, and what is your fascination with people who have a gift of gab, people who are really great at talking?
I think it's a sort of, to a degree, a sort of lost art in screenplays. Dialogue seems to have been relegated. I mean, there's a few wordsmiths like Tarantino, which are conspicuous for their dialogue, but really there aren't many. And one of the things that I enjoy most in a film is when a sentence is constructed in a quirky, non-traditional fashion. And everything about it sort of makes me feel alive. So I'm into dialogue, and I like, you can get so much, you get all the obvious stuff out of dialogue, but people seem to just don't spend any time with dialogue anymore. It just doesn't get the attention it deserves.
Well, either there's one person who's a funny person in the piece, or everybody's speaking in exposition, and it's almost like you have it's like you're colorblind when it comes to that kind of thing. The idea of somebody standing around laying plot pipe, you can't stand it, or you can't see it, or you're just not interested in it.
Yes, I think you can make a virtue out of something that is traditionally either there's too much shoe leather or too much pipe that's laid to get the exposition across. And I just think I'll just embrace it and make a virtue out of it, turn it into a methodology.
Or a game.
A game, something where it goes from being boring to entertaining.
Well, it's also, too, that so many of the characters in your movies are storytellers. I mean, so they're telling a story within the context of the story. And that goes back to Lock, Stock, doesn't it? I mean, people who are storytellers telling a story about something in the movie.
Do you know, it's funny. What's interesting is during these interviews, there's all sorts of things you learn about your own work. And you would have thought after several thousand interviews that I've already given that's never come up before. And I've never actually thought about it before. So you've got storytellers within a storyteller's story.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about it. And it's an interesting point. Next time I come back, Elvis, I'll be able to explain. I'll be able to tell you more about that. But I think what it is I'm attracted to storytellers. And I think the first, you know, there was all these old Cockneys. I used to go to a gym in South London somewhere. And there was an old Jewish Cockney geezer that used to, whenever I used to go in there, he knew I loved a yarn. And, he used to work on the docks in the East End of London, and he could tell these spectacular yarns. And he, like, in 2 minutes, it'd be like a commercial, it'd be like a short movie, and he'd give you all the characters, and he'd tell you about Frankie Four Fingers and Fred the Head and Jack the Knife and all that tosh. And he was so animated in, I got so much of Snatch came from this guy in terms of his ability to tell a story. And then I realized, hold on, everything's about storytellers. You can take a relatively mundane narrative, give it to the right man who's got a sense of theatre, and before you know it, you're off to the races. So I suppose to have storytellers within stories makes sense to me because I'm titillated by storytellers.
But it's almost as if you're servicing your own need to sort of stay interested in these things, isn't it? I mean, it's got to be something that keeps you juiced as you're constructing this thing, right?
Yes. Yeah, a bit like interviews. That's why I quite like a question that, you know, no one's or an observation that I haven't thought about before, because now I'm having to think, Elvis. How dare you force me into thinking?
Without a beer. What's wrong with me?
It's rather dry in here, Elvis. It's just it's not going to happen, is it?
You don't mean bright, dry in a British sense, do you? But it also means you've got to cast actors who are, I mean, it goes back to your finding Jason Statham and Fleming and those guys, but continually finding people who are those kinds of showmen who can lend that kind of theatricality to the storytelling, right?
Yeah, particularly Statham, actually. Statham is a great storyteller. And our opening scene in Lock, Stock was Statham telling a story. And that was his pitch that he used to give on the street when he was selling, you know, all the whatnots and trinkets that he used to sell on the street. And I suppose I'm attracted to him because of that. The pattern, I'm starting to see the pattern here, Elvis. I don't know where I'm talking about. I need a beer, Elvis, to wake me up.
No, nothing but the DTs in here for you, Guy. I'm sorry. But it makes me wonder, though, when you looked at Charlie Hunnam to cast him, did you see that in him? Because he hadn't really done that kind of thing before.
Charlie Stunning. I quite like that. I wish I was called Charlie Stunning.
I'm giving him a stripper's name, yes.
I did, when I talked to him, I had actually, and I jest when I say I didn't know who Charlie Hunnam was to various people, because he did declare, I know his manager very well. And she said, look, would you see him? And I went, I'm not really sure he's my guy. And she said, look, he's coming anyway, and he's going to get on an airplane. He's going to pay for it himself. Do him the favor of having a cup of tea with him. So he turned up, we had a cup of tea.
Just tea?
No, not just tea.
Okay.
And it became... I didn't think who he was, his work reflected who he was, in the sense that within 5 minutes I thought, oh, I can work with this bloke. Because to me, everything's about tonality. So whenever I meet an actor about a film, the last thing I'm interested in talking about is the film. What I'm interested in talking about is, are you on the same frequency? You know, do you get the same jokes? Can you say non-PC gags? Do you get judged as being a bigot, or do you get judged as being irreverent? You know, and do you get those things? And the shorthand, essentially what I want is a shorthand with an actor. And it became apparent quickly that Charlie had a shorthand. So I knew he could be that guy, if you know what I mean. I knew I could elicit, that's the right word, some charm from him. And that was my principal concern. It's funny, I just saw a trailer for this. It's on Comedy Central. They did a little, like a teaser for the movie. And it's Charlie and Jude taking the mickey out of one another. And it's very good. This must have cost $500 to have pulled off this thing. But what I love most about it, it's on my Instagram. By the way, I have about four people that follow me on Instagram. So
let's get up to five.
So, but my wife passed it to me. And I have to tell you, it's really funny. And the reason it's funny is because it's tonality and it's frequency. And I'm thinking that whoever likes that would like the film. So, I mean, I know that lots of money's been spent. I know the action's going to be, you know, razzle-dazzle. I know the visual effects are going to be so-so. But what's the tone? What's the frequency? And that, for me as an audience member, I want to know, you know, what's good about Chris Pratt? Is you go, I like Chris Pratt. Why do I like Chris Pratt? Because I get his tone. I get his frequency. He was a fat guy that became a good-looking guy. And because he was a fat guy, he had to develop charm. Now he's a good-looking guy and he's charming. I get all of that. But I like him, and I like him. I'm interested in his work. And I think, you know, that's what I mean. This is the competition, by the way, and it's rather formidable competition. I shouldn't be talking about him at all. But
sorry, I brought him up.
But that's my point. My point being, it was just because he's everywhere. I used him as an example.
Sure.
But this little spot, to me, told me a tone that I thought, right, I like those guys. I'll be in. And I suppose that's what I had with Charlie Hunnam. I went, I like him. I want to use him.
But it's also a thing, too, where you talk to him, you realize nobody's ever asked him to be funny before. You know, he's often this thing we're talking about, that kind of almost like soldier-like version of, well, this happened and this happened and this happened. And he realized he almost never cracks a smile in movies.
No. I think this is, you know, this can be the great curse of actors and directors that want to be taken seriously. The price of being wanted to be taken seriously is so vast. And it's sort of all for nothing. Great, be taken seriously, but that doesn't mean you can't have fun on the route to being taken seriously. And I think Charlie just needed to do some fun work. And I got the feeling, and in fact I now know, knowing him very well, that he never had the license to be funny. And he was never encouraged to be funny because he's funny. And all you needed to dial in was that, because he's an incredibly technical actor. He's worked very hard for a long time, and he's really earned his stripes, which I didn't fully appreciate until I started working with him. So the thing was, I just needed to corrupt his earnestness. And as soon as that was corrupted, which took about 30 seconds, because there's a few of the chaps, and we started sniggering, as you could see him sort of working himself up into a bit of a Shakespearean lava. And then he could hear a bit of sniggering taking place, and then he realised it was up. But because he was on the right frequency, he took that in the right way. And then from there on, you know, I don't like to say this because I like to take as much credit as I can for the funny lines. But thereafter, he came up with quite a lot of the funny lines.
My guest who's getting generous in his lack of Instagram followers is Guy Ritchie. His new film as director is King Arthur. I guess this gets to this thing that if we look at your career, we go from the kind of close to the ground stuff you did, almost folkloric stuff you did when you started, to these really like big iconic stories in the last four films you've done. What precipitated that for you? Because you know one of my favorite films of yours is Revolver, and we had this conversation before, and that was almost the shift to me that you're doing bigger kinds of stuff.
Firstly, thank you for that, the Revolver comment. I mean, I want to be challenged. I want to be challenged as a filmmaker, and I can see the dangers of being typecast into a particular genre. I can recognize that, and I don't want to do that because it's comfortable for me to do that. So when I
do, you recognize how comfortable it is for you to do that? I mean,
I recognize that it's very hard for me to evolve if I'm comfortable in every respect, really. Trouble was, I was quite snotty about the work that I would choose to make. And then one day I thought, I'm overthinking this. The next script that turns up on my desk, I'm just going to do it. Next script that turned up on my desk was Sherlock Holmes. I didn't particularly like the script. But guess what? I went, it's a challenge. I'm going to turn that into something that I like, that I'll attempt to impose some version of a voice and a vision upon it and give me that as a challenge. We used to have this program back in the UK. I thought it was called Blue Peter. And they used to give you an empty squidgy bottle and a toilet roll, a bit of duct tape, a cup of coffee, a couple of pens. And they'd say, turn it into a boat that could propel itself across a bathtub, right? And you just had to make something up out of it. And I've taken that approach towards filmmaking. Give me something that's tricky. Give me a bit of duct tape. Give me an empty coffee cup, and I'll see what I can do. I'll see if I can turn that into a boat or a rocket that can fly up, 200 feet or whatever it is. And I like that challenge. And I think as soon as Sherlock landed on my desk, I went, right, I'm not going to overthink this anymore. I like the title of Sherlock Holmes, and that's enough for me. And I'm going to go to work on it. And then since then, I'm sort of following that pattern. I think, right, oh, give me that one. Oh, I'm not sure I'd do that. Oh, that's a musical. Oh, that's a bit scary. But oh, and as soon as you embark, 2 weeks in, you feel pretty confident about that you can impose. Well, impose is maybe not the right word.
Why? Because it is imposing your sensibility on it, isn't it?
It is, but I'm nervous about using the word impose because I don't want to get in the way.
Okay.
I probably do want to get in the way.
I'm just going to say, yeah, I don't know. I don't think I'm buying this for a second. You're not that good an actor. But you, because for me, I've always, and we've talked about this a little bit before, you have such a, I think, a low threshold of boredom that you've got to like find a way to do these things in a way that engages you. And the idea of Sherlock Holmes, which has been done, with the exception actually of the old Basil Rathbone movies, then done basically in the same way for the last 60 or 70 years, you couldn't stomach the idea of seeing it done that way again, could you?
No, I couldn't, and that is to do with boredom. And I just, what's the point in doing it? And I had a similar philosophy towards King Arthur, is that this could be heavy weather. And it's funny, actually, now the title's out there, a lot of our work is to make it apparent that it's not your daddy's King Arthur. And I always thought people would sort of know that, but they don't. They need to be reminded because I suppose they're up against the thing that I'm up against. Who cares unless it's fresh?
On that note, we'll take a break. My guest who's in desperate need of a drink is Guy Ritchie. His new film is director is King Arthur. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Welcome back. It's always a thrill I have Guy Ritchie here, if only because he disagrees with all my questions. We're talking about his new film as director, King Arthur, and we were talking about folklore before the break. And that's the sense I get from your experience and what you want to get across in movies, that the stories have been, and this is even a part of the film so often, stories that have been passed along. And if it's being told by the right narrator, as you were putting it, it's memorable. People want to repeat the details and give that same sense of pleasure that they got from hearing these stories.
Yes, it's the skill of the narrator, really, isn't it? As it gets passed down the line, that's why the idea of lore L-O-R-E, is so attractive to me, as opposed to once it's written down, it becomes formalized, it loses some of its zhuzh. And it's the Lorik tradition that there's something sexy about it. It's kind of gypsy-esque. It's mysterious, mystical mythology. I'm trying to find another word with an M in it.
Well, as long as it's not moribund, I guess that's the important thing. But I think what you do in your visuals is there's kind of correlative where these stories that are told are teeming with the tale, and your frames are always packed with people and packed with the tale. And it's like you're looking in your way to find the visual, basically visual support to that kind of storytelling that you're in love with.
Yes. Yes, you're right. I am interested in the picture itself. Principally, I'm interested in the narrative. But once you're interested in the narrative, then I suppose if you like chicken, it's really, you know, chicken tastes nice, but it's important the sauce that you put on composition. Otherwise, it's just chicken, right? So you have to take your sauces quite seriously. And you, if you know you've got good chicken, that's great. So there's your story. There's the essence of your story. Now it's all about the sauce. And I like to think I take the sources quite seriously.
But there's always, I mean, going back to your first film, that, and I wonder where this comes from in visual terms, that the frame's so teeming with detail and incidents, not just a bunch of people, but there's tons of things going on. Were you always confident that you could get this across and not confuse people? Because there's so much going on that, you know, if there's a misstep, people could be easily, like, confused by it. But that doesn't happen. We know where we are in visual terms and in narrative terms as these stories are taking place.
Yeah, I think you and I might have a similar frequency on these things anyway, Elvis. So as long as you get the gist, as long as you get the point of the expression, then all the peripheral stuff is great fun. But it's not really the literal word that's important. What's important is the tonality and the expression of the actors. And that is, again, to do with this chicken sauce. It's to do with everything that's in the equation. And I find if you're dense with the amount of information that you put in a frame, you can keep watching a film again and again and again. And the other thing is you can pick it up at any point and put it down at any point because it's not bound to a linear narrative. I like a linear narrative. I like a beginning. I like a middle and an end. But I also like short films within a big film.
Stories within stories.
Stories. Well, there we go. You know more about this than I do.
I've watched a couple of your films once or twice. But I do think, too, that there's this, as you were talking about this, certainly it's folkloric, but I always think of your stuff as really like song cycles. I mean, that when you hear a song, if you hear a song halfway through, it like immediately sort of sets off all those emotional reactions the first time you heard it. And it's knowing where to place the frame where there's a surprise in it, but it also immediately sort of stirs something in you that you want to have stirred again. And I think for me, your movies work as much as they do, like even though there's not really pop in the last few films, well, I could take if we take out Man from U.N.C.L.E., but we look at the Sherlock Holmes, Revolver, and now King Arthur, they feel like it's almost like needle drops to me in some way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I did take the score very seriously. I mean, I was never sure I was going into the music business or the film business. The good thing about actually being in the film business is you're in the music business and the film business. So I spent 3 years on this score, and I wanted it to be a bold score.
Lots of themes. I mean, it really isn't. Interestingly, the score is both kind of like energetic but old-fashioned romantic score in that we know we are emotionally when certain pieces of music, themes return, don't we?
Yes, we do. And I find that narrative is subservient to rhythm, which any composer that I've ever worked with is always sort of defers to me. And my job is to make sure he understands that I defer to him. Simply by natural law, rhythm controls narrative. And the most conspicuous form of that is music. So I find that for me, I like a rhythm within my films because I like a kinetic energy, if you will. But I can really indulge myself in the most conspicuous form of that, which is music. So I try, inevitably what ends up happening is I basically cut my films to music. I tell you, it's hard work. You know, my last composer and I, it's a love-hate relationship, that one.
I get the feeling, though, you don't mind having a bit of a love-hate relationship, that you like having some pushback because
I like
you don't want, again, you don't want to be bored, do you?
Yeah, and also I like good cop, I like bad cop. I never want to be indulged to the point that I start to drift, and that does happen. And I've seen directors get too much authority and hubris creeps into the equation, and then before you know it, you have a poo movie. And I'm subject as much as the next man to those laws. So I am aware of the benefits of having a bad cop in the equation.
Well, you're a little concerned, by the way, because the last few films have been period films. And for the first half of your career, you were very much a contemporary filmmaker.
Yeah, it's probably because I couldn't afford to create period films.
Okay, fair enough.
It's because if I could afford more style in my original films, I would have put more style into it.
What do you mean by more style? I mean, they're pretty stylized films as it is. What do you think?
Are they? As long as they are, you reassure me when you tell me that, actually. Obviously.
That's not the point of this. Again, I'm the bad cop here. Did you really think, though, that you're liberated by having resources so you can, like, do period films?
Well, I'm into some version of escapism because it's implicit that that is consistent with what you and I have been talking about, which is sexy narrative, Lorik tradition. Give me something in a way that feels titillating and exciting and fresh. Give me the nuances. Give me the subculture. Give me the details. Don't be traditional. Highlight the things that everyone else wouldn't highlight. And try as much as you can not to be conventional.
It's a treat when I'm talking with a very unconventional guy, Richie, whose new film is an even more unconventional, King Arthur. I mean, part of this, taking on, again, Holmes or Man from U.N.C.L.E. or King Arthur, is you're taking on something that people think they know. And you like the idea of sort of upending people's idea of what they think they know about these concepts, don't you?
Yes, I do. Forgive me, I'm going to start repeating myself here.
I'm usually
a lot more loquacious if I'm allowed a beer, Elvis.
But again, these are big things that people think they know, you know?
Yeah, but to me that's exciting, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, here you go. You've seen it before, or have you?
Yeah, or have you? I mean, did you see these movies as a kid?
Yes, I did. And I did like John Borman's movie. It came out in the 80s.
Excalibur.
And I was
excited
by that.
Which is another take on a very different take on the same thing we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a very different take. It was very aggressive. And they put a lot of narrative, too much in my opinion. They squidged it. They concertinaed it. What probably could have been made into 10 movies, into a movie. So he set up a kind of really interesting tone. And everyone shouts at everyone. And that's how they talk, the whole film. And it took me years to actually work out that's why it felt so intense. But that is quite a simple idea. And I tell you, I was quite tempted to do it in this one. Just everyone shout at everyone. Don't talk to anyone. Just shout at him and see what happens. I bet people won't pick up on it. They'll just feel it as though it's intense. So that's what Borman did in his. He did that. And, you know, of course, he had no visual effects. So he stuck a lot of green gel on the lights and got a few mirrors and shimmied them about, which now it looks rather sad and dated now. But he had some sort of wonderful ideas of Pendragon riding into the castle on the dragon's breath. And Merlin was up to all sorts of shenanigans with Mandrake and Morgana and whatnot.
Were you ever going to have a Merlin in this? Were you thinking about that?
Well, I wanted to stick Merlin in the next one because the problem is Merlin himself is such an undertaking that I didn't want to get distracted by Merlin. So I wanted to just do with an Arthur and a sword and the setting up of laying the table of the table. And that was more than enough to deal with in these 2 hours. It was a 3.5-hour movie. And talk about concertina, I turned it into a 2-hour movie.
But I guess, too, I just find myself thinking about this idea of, for you, I think these movies have weirdly a kind of a timeless feel. Like, you know, you look at the first few movies, which are very contemporary, but, you know, there's not a lot of reliance on stuff that makes them feel really dated. I mean, they could be British gangster movies from the 70s. And I feel like that idea of maybe folkloric for you translates into something that feels timeless, you know?
Elvis, you're a therapist.
You need a beer. Clearly, you need a beer.
No, honestly, you know, you're telling me things here that certainly speak to me, and honestly, things that I haven't thought about before. I feel as though I should pay you at the end of this session.
You should, but we know you're not going to. But instead, let me ask you this, because I guess as you're talking about the Bourbon, I was struck, we were thinking about the colors in that, and there's all that gold and all
gold
that,
and green
and yeah. green. And this is very conspicuously not those colors in this. I mean, you made a point of breaking from that. In fact, there are sections that could almost feel like they're in black and white.
Yeah. I think what Bourbon did was he decided to make a commitment. The commitment was everyone's going to shout at everyone. And there's going to be green. And there's going to be gold. And there's going to be lots of armor. And the armor's going to be really, really shiny.
And loud.
And they were kind of decisions that he made, and I like him for that. He went, this is what we're doing. And I suspect that's why he captured my attention, because someone was very definitive about the story they were going to tell. I have no idea what all that green bollocks was about, but it didn't really matter because it was such a commitment. What I'm trying to do is use Bourbon as a metaphor for moi. I want to, oh God, there's no way of getting around this word, impose my influence upon the narrative.
What is your winking disagreement with the word impose?
I mean, it just sounds sort of like it.
Are you worried that people are going to take you too seriously? That you, I mean, because you joke about what you kind of do, but you actually clearly work very hard on these things. And there is, it's funny to me that you work really hard to make it seem like you don't work very hard.
I do work very hard. It's true. And this film, you know, took up a lot of my time for 3 years.
More time than you thought?
Twice the time. I thought it'd be a year and a half, and here I am 3 years later. What I do take seriously is the essence of narrative. And as a filmmaker, it's taken me a long time to be able to articulate the essence of narrative. And I want to take the essence seriously. Outside of the essence, I then want to have fun. And I think you can have your cake and eat it if you make sure that you capture the essence of a narrative.
But there are things you like to do to surprise audiences. For example, like giving Jude Law what's a kind of a subsidiary role, but still a role that I think for him being liberated from having to carry a movie lets him have fun with it in a way that even seems to surprise him sometimes. Casting Robert Downey Jr. as a Brit, surprising actors, but also surprising audiences by putting in either new people or people in unexpected positions, going back to putting Charlie Hunnam in this. These are all parts of the things that really appeal to you.
All I can do is nod and agree.
Well, given that you're clearly out of answers, we'll take a pause until the next time you're around. What's your next thing going to be? Is it going to be the next one of these?
Well, the next thing's going to be Aladdin.
You actually are doing Aladdin.
I'm doing Aladdin.
Well, I guess you'll be back to talk to that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to let my guest, Guy Ritchie, the director of King Arthur, go off and have some kind of drink that clearly isn't water, and thank our recording engineer who also mixes the show, Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Wright, who's associate producer. I want some chicken. It's the treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.